and welcome to the Impact Interviews. My name's Laura, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Ralph Pickles, who's here to tell us about the Quorn story. Hi, Ralph.
Hi.
Hi, hi. So thank you for joining us today. We're really interested to hear about you and the Quorn story. And I was wondering if you could start with how Quorn began.
Yeah, the fundamental thing started in the 1960s when there was a general view that the world would run out of food and especially protein. So population growth, agricultural productivity not increasing quickly enough, and a general feeling that protein would be deficient. And so a number of companies around the world started looking for ways of making protein, mostly for animal feed, from hydrocarbons, which were cheap at the time. And that process led to a number of developments which fizzled out because oil got to be more expensive and approvals were difficult. But Rankovis MacDougall, Lord Rank, set out looking for a new way of producing human food from agricultural materials of high protein content. So in all that happened in the 1960s. By 1985, Quorn was approved for sale. But by then, the fundamental issue had changed. Agricultural productivity around the world had increased much quicker than population growth, and protein for animal feed in particular was much more available after the Brazilians planted soybeans in the highlands and a new strain of colza rape was developed, which turned into yellow flowers all over Europe at harvest time. So Quorn hit the market 20-something years into its story of development in the mid-80s, looking for its main purpose in life as a high-protein, high-quality food. Mm-hmm. And so the first issue, of course, was who would value it and why would they buy it? Mm-hmm. Well, who would value it would be... people who, it has three principal raison d'etre. One is it's low calorie. One is that it's high satiety. So if you're trying to lose weight, it's vegetarian and it's healthy because it lowers cholesterol. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much where it got to in the mid 60s. In the mid 80s.
So it sounds like a superfood. So that's why it's amazing, right? Because it's low calorie, it fills you up, it's vegetarian, and it's high in protein. So
yes. And so who in the mid-80s, who would buy it? Vegetarianism was not particularly common then. Mm. Most men, particularly older men, had the general view in marketing terms that meat and two veg was a meal and anything else was a snack.
Yeah.
Whereas younger women are particularly concerned about shape and appearance and lifestyle and things were much more amenable to the idea that anything that you ate at mealtimes that satisfied your needs was a meal. So marketing was very much aimed at 25 to 35 ABC1 female.
Mm-hmm.
Quorn itself was originally invented with the notion that it would be a cheap food. But there are two problems with that. Firstly, people don't value things that are cheap. They value things that are good. And secondly, whilst the variable cost of manufacture can be quite low, there's a fairly high capital cost involved. There was a lot of research and development involved. And to bring a product to market, you need to advertise it, and that's not cheap. Mm. So where would you position Quorn into the market? And the answer was really against off-the-bone chicken breast meat, so right. An equivalent. So Quorn was being presented as another protein alongside beef and pork and chicken and corn. So a new option in the culinary vocabulary.
And how did it go at first? Did people understand the concept or was there resistance?
It was fairly difficult at first, particularly because you need to get shelf space in supermarkets. There was quite a lot of interest in a novel food. But if you when you talk to supermarket retailers, senior people make strategy decisions and buyers buy. And buyers don't like to be told what to buy. So we had to learn to sell at multiple levels. We had to sell the strategic concept at very senior levels so that people leading the supermarkets were prepared to see it on shelf. And we had to give a reason for the buyer to buy it, which was couched in different terms. The other thing, we always wanted to launch corn as a product in its own right. And you'll know that on the shelves now, you can buy corn mince and you can buy corn pieces. But we were very worried in the early days that people approaching it from scratch would not know how to cook it well. And if you cook it badly and you have a bad experience, then that would put you off from the start. So the early launches were ready meals and the like. And they were launched initially on the supermarket owned brands. So only once we'd had a year or two of own brand product sales were we able to launch dice and mince and to launch a corn cookbook and to start to talk people about using corn in its rightful way.
Oh, I didn't. I never knew there was a corn cookbook.
Oh yes, on the websites at the time there were multiple recipes. And of course, we employed a number of people whose role it was to invent recipes to use corn.
What was your favorite? May I?
Oh,
What was your favorite corn?
I can't. It's hard to describe actually, but there was a very nice Chinese meal that was made with mirin. If you remember mirin, or if you know mirin, rather, it's still around. Which I thought was great. One of the great disappointments, actually, is whenever we developed a very nice product, we'd show it to potential supermarkets and they'd agree that they liked it. And then it would go into focus groups. And by the time it had been through a few focus groups, it came back usually much more bland than it started out. And that was kind of disappointing. It became a product for every man rather than a rather or every woman rather than a product that was as unique as it started out. So I'm sure our product development people used to be quite frustrated by that.
And so you had these ready meals, and then you introduced the cookbook, and then you could introduce corn as an ingredient. Is that
Yes.
how the follow? And
That was that, yeah.
sorry.
And that's how the sequence went. And supporting that, we started with double page spreads in women's magazines as the way to sell it, going back to the target market. And as sales grew, we were then able to start television advertising, and mostly with celebrities that would add credibility to the product. So we used people like Sally Gummel, who was then the captain of the British Olympic team. We used Will Carling, who was captain of the British the England rugby team. We used Ryan Giggs, who at the time was running football activities for teenagers on a television show on a Sunday morning. So people who could add credibility to the product and add endorsement.
And so were you right in thinking about who the first target market was in the end, or did you find out that it was someone else who was the main
No,
buyer?
it definitely was. I mean, we were never able to turn around elderly men. And of course, another reason why the younger age group, those people who'd been exposed to international travel in the 60s and 70s on holiday were much more amenable to recipes that were a bit different from the very traditional and British food. And it's quite interesting how that market has changed over the years, because if you went into supermarkets in the 1970s, 80s, most of the food was sort of traditional British and rather bland. Whereas if you went overseas, you would find much more exciting things. But that's changed dramatically with the influx of immigration in this country and with foreign holidays. And nowadays, I think the offerings in supermarkets here are far more varied and far more interesting. I mean, I lived in the United States for a while, and that was much less interesting than here.
Which is unusual, which is surprising. I would have thought with the level of immigration in the US that it would be very varied.
Well, I can't defend the American market, but if you look at the populations in America, there are groups that have been immigrant groups that have been there for some length of time, like the Germans, like the Italians. But most of the immigrants now are from South America, from Mexico, and so on and so forth. Whereas if you look at the people coming into this country from South Asia, from East Asia, it's a much more varied landscape. So if you want a really good curry, you'll find one on a supermarket shelf here, whereas you wouldn't in the United States.
And did you find any pushback against call?
Not really. I mean, introducing a new food had various challenges. One was getting regulatory approval to sell a novel food, and that was a challenge in itself, because the regulators didn't have a yardstick by which to measure it. And regulators around the world all invented different yardsticks, so that was quite a jumping through a lot of hoops to get permission to sell. The other thing about eating something new is that some people, when they eat something new, have a reaction. And so in the early days, we did a lot of clinical research with corn in lots of settings to prove that it was as valuable as it is, and it really is, and it passed all of those. Anyone who said that they had an allergic reaction, we referred to a specialist in a London hospital, and those people were tested and generally found that their allergenicity was psychological, because they'd eaten something that was strange and they thought about it a lot. And we didn't actually ever find anyone who was allergic to corn, which isn't to say there isn't anybody, but I don't know of anyone. And the other thing is that corn got onto the GCSE syllabus at the time. And so we had to organize people to teach teachers how to teach corn as part of the syllabus. And at that time, there was a lot of concern about genetic engineering and frankenfoods and the like. And corn is not any of those things. Corn is produced from glucose, which comes from maize. And it's produced in a process very similar to the production of yogurt. And all the ingredients are essentially natural. And what you're growing is natural. So there's no genetic manipulation. There's no frankenfoods about it. But that had to be taught, or that myth had to be dispelled.
So did you want it to be on the GCSE curriculum, or did you just have it done to you?
It was done to us. We suddenly found out that it was. And I've no idea how it got on there. Somebody must have thought it was quite an interesting thing. I mean, it obviously spans a number of things like biology, like engineering science. I mean, corn is grown in very large vats, so there's quite a bit of engineering about it. It's production, much as there is for most of the large food processing industry. I mean, if you watch these television programs that are around at the moment, into the factory. I mean, the kit that's used to make the food that we eat every day is very large and very sophisticated, and people don't appreciate that unless they've been and seen it. And Quorn's no different to that. So lots of engineering, lots of interesting biotechnology, but all built around a natural product.
And so, do you have any idea about how many people have eaten corn, or how many people eat corn in any year?
Well, no, I don't. I mean, I became responsible for the corn business in the 1980s. What happened in the 1980s is that RHM, who had been working on it for 20 years, got approval to sell the product, but they couldn't. They didn't have the engineering capability that was required to make it at scale, and so a partnership was formed with ICI, who at the time did have the capability of manufacturing at scale. And that partnership lasted for 5 years. And at the end of the 5 years, ICI bought out, or I negotiated for ICI to buy out the RHM share. And it carried on then as a business that was in ICI, subsequently in Zeneca when ICI cut itself in half. We invested very heavily in capital and television advertising at that point. But yeah, how many people? When I left the business, gosh, 1995, we were selling around about 100 million pounds worth of product a year, 120 million pounds worth of product a year. So if you work out that most of the finished products were selling at 2 or 3 pounds, that's quite a lot of product walking off the shelves. And of course, the business is much bigger than that today. So the short answer is an awful lot of people have eaten it.
And how many countries did you?
Well, when I left, it was 6 countries. I really don't know how many countries it's in today. And I said the regulators were interesting. When we went to the United States, they asked us to do all sorts of tests to prove its worth. So we said, well, do you have any experience of doing those tests and people being successful at doing that? And they said, no, we don't. So anyway, we did their tests and we proved. We went back to them and said, here are the results. It works. And they said, great. What we're going to do is we're not going to give you approval. What we will do is give you a letter saying that we're not going to oppose sale.
Right.
So corn got onto the shelves in the supermarkets in the United States in the, from memory, 93-ish thereabouts. To my knowledge, corn is still not an approved product in the United States. It's just not a disapproved product.
And so, how did you start with those first 6 countries? Did you start in the UK, then go to the US? Where else did you go?
Oh, it started in the UK and then spread into Europe,
Right.
and then to the US. We also talked in the 80s to a number of the very large food companies to know whether they were interested in being involved. But by and large, I think they all found it rather challenging. So we talked to a very large Japanese company who were quite interested in doing it. We talked to very large European and American companies, but in the end, the issue for very large companies in starting with something that at that stage wasn't very big is how do they manage something strategic that isn't of a sufficient size to attract the interest of the main board? And I've seen examples of that elsewhere in history. When I left Quorn, I went to join a flavor company, an international flavor company. The largest private company in the world, Cargill, a while ago bought a flavor company and ran it for a few years and then sold it. And my understanding, rightly or wrongly, is that it was strategically different, but not big enough to be managed strategically properly. And so it didn't really fit with their way of doing business.
And it's a little bit chicken and egg, isn't it? You need to be quite a big organization to align all the resources to make the small thing into a big enough thing to get the attention that it needs.
Yes, it really depends. It really depends on the nature of the business, how specialized it is. If If you start with something, well, if you take a pharmaceutical, for example, that's generally fairly straightforward. You've got something that would that treats a particular condition, and it's not complicated. If you start with something like a flavor company, where any flavor will be made up typically of 60 or 80 natural ingredients, all blended to a special, and then will only be applied to one or two end products. It's a very complex business. And the management of a complex business like that and the understanding of how to grow it requires, well, it's a true specialty business. It's not a it requires a detailed understanding because what you're selling is not a a product as such. You're selling an effect. You're selling a taste in a product, which is not the same thing as selling a product that's use is defined by the product.
Yeah, and I think I see that with other people that I've spoken to on this podcast is that they're trying to do something new. They're trying to do something that has an effect on people. And in general, the people that I speak to on this podcast kind of tell me that it's hard. Like it's hard to convey the effect that they're creating. It's hard to convey the size, the magnitude of the effect that they're creating. And it's hard to necessarily get people to kind of join the mission, if you like, join the fight.
Well, yes, that's right. If what you're selling has a specific effect rather than being a specific thing, it's hard to describe. And sometimes it's hard to measure the effect. And the other thing that people often confuse is if you see a market that's vast and you think your product can fit into that market, you often find people saying, "Oh, well, we believe we can get 1 or 2% of this enormous market," and that doesn't exist. What they're going to do if they're successful is get 20 or 30% of a niche of that market, and they need to know what that niche is, and they need to market into that niche, and not think that they're going to get. I mean, I don't know. Let's try and think of an example. If you invented a new way of making motor car tires, for example, you're not going overnight to get a quarter of a percent of the world's market for motor car tires. What you're going to find is that your particular tire has something special about it that will appeal to people who drive certain kinds of cars. And if you're lucky, you'll get a decent share of that niche.
Yeah, some people think about the market in a strange
So
way.
going back to corn, of course, when corn first started, it was a unique product in the market. And people used to say to me, "Aren't you worried about having a competitor, someone copying what you're doing?" And my reaction to that was, "Well, given the hill that we've had to climb to get there, I think it's unlikely that we will have a competitor." Because anyone trying to follow us will need deep pockets, as RHM and ICI had. But actually, I'd quite like to have a competitor because a competitor would expand the market and make more interest in people buying products of this type.
And so if we as we come to a close, if you think about when corn first started and all the sort of hints and tips and things that you learned from that stage, if there's someone listening that thinks, oh, I want to do something, I want to start something, do you have one key tip or one piece of advice that you would share with them?
Well, if you think if there's something that's really worthwhile doing that you're passionate about, definitely go for it. I mean, don't be put off, but do think very carefully about the route, what the obstacles will be, what the costs are going to be to get to where you want to be, who's going to value the product as much as you do, and where it's all going to end up. I mean, so go for it, but go for it with your eyes open and having thought about what it's really like. And there's an old Harvard Business School that thing that says, if you think you can invent something, before you spend any money trying to invent it, think about whether anyone will want it once you've invented it. Don't spend money developing something until you've spent some time thinking about where it's going. Because one of the classic examples, of course, is the perfect lawnmower. And the classic example is that a company bankrupted itself making a lawnmower that would make the grass perfectly flat like a bowling green. In reality, a perfect lawnmower is one that starts every time you pull the cord. And as long as the grass ends up shorter, it doesn't have to be perfect.
Now that is a good thing to good place to end. Okay, Ralph, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to the Impact Interviews. If you enjoyed this episode, then please check out our back catalogue. And if you've any questions for either us or our guests, then please be sure to get in touch. We'll be back next week with something new. So see you soon.